where so much activity took place because they were air-conditioned and the air outside was air-conditioning's opposite. Manila could be a kiln, and they all baked in it together. But now, after months of being there, making money and eating adobo and crispy pata and staying out late partying with clients far from Greer, who was waiting for him while she lived her own life in another city, here he was in a state of unmanageable grief, roaring in a taxi with a broken seatbelt toward the Manila airport to fly home to be with his family because his brother was dead. He was glad there was no seatbelt. He didn't even want one. "You can crash this car if you want," he said to the driver. "I don't give a shit." "What do you say?" said the driver, looking in the rearview mirror to assess the situation. "You can drive straight off the road. I want to be dead. I want to die." "But I don't want to die," said the driver. "I think you're a crazy man," he added with a tense laugh. But his curiosity bested him, and in a milder voice he asked, "Why do you want to die?" "My brother was run over by a car and killed. My mother was driving." "I am sorry," said the taxi driver reflexively. "Your brother, a little boy or a man?"
"A little boy."
Corey recalled his brother's intelligent, animated face, knowing it would deanimate and recede over time. It would have to.
"Oh, that is terrible."
Then, without a word, the driver pulled onto the shoulder of the highway. The sky held a smudge of incipient sunlight. They sat together in the unmoving car, and the driver pulled out a pack of jackpot menthols and tipped out one to Corey, who took it from the slot in the plastic partition. The driver slid him a lighter, then took it back and lit one for himself, too. In silent misery, they smoked. The night turned to morning, accompanied by the taste of a proffered menthol jackpot cigarette that still stayed on his tongue as he moved through the airport terminal to travel home. This time, no business class seat was available, and the firm probably wouldn't have paid for it anyway. He would have no bed to cradle his tall and suddenly fragile self. Corey sat in the only seat he could get, in the very last row by the toilet, a middle seat where he was squeezed between a big, meaty man and a big, meaty woman. He was wedged there, crying and watching a Filipino movie without the subtitles because he figured it would fill his head with words he couldn't follow and fill his eyes with brightly moving colors and flashes of flesh. There were no deaths of children in the movie, only drama that involved love and marriage and infidelity and sex, always sex, which interested everyone on every continent. Then the movie was over and he was back to himself, lodged unhappily in the narrow space between his seatmates. One of them, he wasn't sure which, smelled of spice and yeast and something a little disturbing and unnameable. But he had been crying so hard and had been releasing such toxic, alarming chemicals that for all he knew, it came from him. Greer was already waiting in Macapie by the time he arrived. He had flown to L.A. and then on to New York and then took a bus up to Springfield and a taxi to town, which was snowy and cold, reminding him that he had no coat with him. Corey hadn't brushed his teeth or gotten washed in a full day. He was a stinking, soaking being with a furred face and mouth. He'd cried intermittently on the flight, feeling ill, and suspecting that this kind of illness would always be with him, either an acute or a chronic expression, depending on the day. The idea of never seeing Albie again, the two of them never having one of those conversations that flew in different directions like an unstable firework, wasn't something he could exactly believe. The taxi pulled up in front of the Pinto house. Various cars were parked out front, blocking the driveway. He recognized Aunt Maria and Uncle Joe's green Pontiac. Corey entered the house through the unlocked door, and his relatives descended upon him, some of them crying, and then they parted, revealing Greer standing there alone. She'd braved the Pinto family scene even without him, She hadn't just been hiding out in her own parents' house until he arrived. His relatives left the two of them in the living room.
"Oh, Corey," she said, which were the right words. "Oh, Corey, come here. I love you. Oh, honey, I love you."
She had rarely called him honey, and he thought, this is weird. Honey was for a moment of extremeness. She had reached out from their usual vocabulary and into that of some other generation. The words that they usually used wouldn't do. Honey was weird, but it was a bridge across the terrifying open space between where they had been and where they now were. A honeyed bridge that would take them forward as best it could. They sat together, him smelling so disgusting even to himself, and Greer so sweet and scared, her eyes a startling red. He was a young teenager when his brother was born, and what an indignity that had been, a baby in the house going wah, wah, wah when you were trying to sleep or do your homework or think about sex. For a long time, Corey had ignored the boring, explosively gassy baby. But then finally the baby began to crawl, and that was interesting. And then he began to talk, and that was super interesting. The things he said, the things he asked. At age 2, to Duarte, "Tell me about fertilizer." And at age 4, to Benedita, regarding one of the macaroni spirals on his plate, "Do you think it feels tense? It's all wound up. That's what Corey says when he feels tense. I'm all wound up."
"I can't believe this," Corey said to Greer now, his head in his hands. "What can I do?" he asked, looking up at her.
"What do you mean?"
"To make it not be true."
"I see." She nodded seriously. "I'll help you."
"How will you do that?"
Greer paused, thinking it through.
"I don't know," she said. "But I will."
Together they sat on the couch with its slippery plastic, and then Corey lay with his head in Greer's lap, both of them wordless and crying for so long that after a while they heard the click-click of a gas burner being turned on. Apparently someone had the idea that eating dinner would be appropriate.
"You got off work to come here?" he thought to ask.
"Oh, it wasn't a big deal. Forget about it."
"But wait," he said.
He tried to focus, a tremendous task, and then he remembered something.
"Wasn't your thing now, your loci thing? With all those people speaking at a conference center, do I have the dates wrong?"
Greer shrugged, which gave the truth away. The first summit, Women and Power, she'd once explained, slightly embarrassed and excited by the sound of it, which she had been working towards since starting at Losi, would start tomorrow morning, and she was needed there. Except she wasn't there. She would miss it.
"You're sure it's okay that you're not there?"
he persisted.
"Of course it is."
She paused.
"When are you going to go upstairs and see your mother?"
"I don't know."
"Corey, you have to. I'm going to go see her too at some point, if you think she'd want that. But you definitely have to go to her now."
Somehow he found the ability to go up there. His father was out at a bar with one of the uncles and had been out for most of the day. His parents' bedroom was dark, the shades pulled, and he walked right in without knocking and just stood there at the bedside, his hands behind his back like a sentry. His mother lay on her side under the chenille bedspread that Corey and Albie used to sit on and pick at, all the little nubs and knobs offering interest and engagement to their always moving hands. She was a mess, of course, able to lift her head only a little.
"Why couldn't you see that he was in the driveway?"
he finally burst out cruelly. She craned her head up at him.
"Corey, you're here."
"Yes, I'm here."
"He wasn't in Rivermuir," she said.
Were you actually looking?
Yes, I swear. I don't know what happened, she said, and she turned away again.
He felt ashamed at the ease of his own cruelty and said more calmly, Well, okay. Okay. Anyway, I'm here.
Then he left the room quickly. Corey's father didn't return all day, and the aunts took care of Benedita, so Corey went to stay with Greer across the street at the Kadetsky house. Both of Greer's parents hugged him and spoke kindly to him, and then left them alone. He showered for a long time in the upstairs bathroom, and then he and Greer lay in her bed and had effortful but strong sex. It had been months since he'd touched her, and he was as responsive as ever, almost as if, through sex, he could work out the insurmountable problem of death. He bumped up against her with his hip bones in a familiar way, though he noticed that her body seemed sleeker now. This was the New York City version of Greer, the version that lived and breathed a life that wasn't his. You would have really liked sex, bro, he thought as Greer touched his penis. You would have loved it. A girl actually touching you down there, and you touching her, doing it openly, mutually, on purpose, bro. Albie had been interested in everything. He'd liked to explore. He would have been all over some girl someday, a brilliant girl who would have been his equal. There was a wake with an open casket. It was just unspeakable to spend the day in the presence of his brother's small body. And then a funeral mass at the Catholic church. His mother fainted at the grave, and his father helped her up, though grudgingly. They were barely speaking, so maybe it wasn't surprising when, 2 days after the funeral, Corey's father appeared on the doorstep of the Kadetsky house, politely asked to see his son, who had set up camp there, and then, alone with him in the kitchen, told Corey that he was going back to Lisbon for a while.
Now?
Yes, I need to get away a little.
So he left, and there was no word from him for a few days, which was surprising to Corey, who just assumed he would be in touch every day. His mother, in all her distress, now had an additional refrain.
Where is Duarte? She asked from her bed.
He went for a short visit to Lisbon, the aunts and uncles and Corey told her several times. But there was no word on when he would be back, so using the phone card in the kitchen drawer, Corey called his father to confront him.
What's the deal? He said. I will stay here for a while longer.
What's a while?
I don't know.
Okay, be straight with me. You're not coming back, are you? Corey said, and there was some deflection and then a sigh, and then the admission that no. He was staying there for the foreseeable future.
But Mom can't manage, Corey said. She just lies in bed.
She has her sisters, and I'll give her money. Plus, I will leave her the car. Now she can go around killing anyone she wants.
But this is a crisis.
I'll miss you, but I can't live with her anymore. My cousin offered me a job here. You are a great son, Duarte added, breaking down.
When Corey told Greer, she said, How can he just do that?
You'll have to ask him yourself if you happen to see him again.
You can stay here with me as long as you want, you know, she said. My parents barely notice that you're in the house, or that I am.
Don't you have to go back down to New York soon? Your job?
He asked her.
It'll keep. Greer, you blew off your summit. I can't believe that you did that. That I made you do that.
You didn't make me. I wanted to.
But they needed you there, right?
She didn't say anything.
Did they say it went okay?
Yes, she said. It went great.
Was Faith Frank angry with you?
He persisted. Corey, said Greer. I'm here of my own free will, okay? Don't worry.
Over the next day and a half, back at his own house, he watched YouTube clips of the panels and speeches at the summit and tracked down various loci hashtags and mentions, some of which were nasty, accusing the foundation of taking blood money from Schrader Capital, but most of which were enthusiastic. "What great energy at the Centauri Center," someone wrote. "Amazing event," someone else wrote. And there were more details about how dynamic the speakers were and how responsive the audience was. He watched the video of Faith Frank's keynote. She was unequivocally sexy at 68. He liked her boots. They had a hint of kink about them. Her speech was intense and serious and witty and rapturously received, and he understood why Greer would be so into her. Women sometimes like to be dazzled by other women. He thought that if he were a woman, he would be into Faith Frank, too. Then he watched the others, all female, the astronaut, the naval commander, the hip-hop artist, the poet whose collection about poverty in America had just won an important prize. Some of the speakers were earnest and well-meaning. Others, like the poet, were thrilling. Plus, there was an impressive multimedia aspect. Enormous wraparound screens showing the speakers out and about in their real lives, and excellent acoustics when a girls' choir from the south side of Chicago sang. Emmett Schrader had spent a lot of money on this, and Greer had missed it all. He felt terrible about it, despite her reassurances. One morning his mother rose up from her bed and came into the kitchen, where Greer and Corey sat with his Aunt Maria. "What's going on, Mom?" he asked warily. "What do you need?"
"I feel the spirit of Albi," she announced. "Genu Deutsch. He is here. He wants me to shed my skin."
She held out her arms and showed them the marks where she had been pulling and scratching at her skin. Later, online, Corey would read about psychotic breaks in the context of mourning. Now he just stared at his mother and couldn't think of anything to say to her. She needed supervision. That was what the aunts and uncles decided. They did what they could, calling her employers and telling them she couldn't make it to work. But they had their own lives and families, and none of them could stay on in Maccabee much longer. Even Greer felt she finally had to get back to work, and Corey said of course she had to go.
"What about you?"
she asked him the next time they were alone.
"I think I'm going to stick around."
"Really? Can you do that?"
"What do you mean? It's what I have to do."
"Okay," she said unsurely.
"What?" he finally said. "What's the matter?"
"It's just that I'm concerned about you, Corey. It shouldn't all fall on you like this."
"But it does, Greer."
"I think you're an amazing son," she said, but this didn't seem at all like a compliment to him.
"Right, I'm amazing," he said tightly. "I'm incredibly amazing. And now I have to stay."
Albie's room called to Corey with the strange ferocity of sound waves coming from deep inside a cave. He had ignored the room until now. But then, once the relatives were gone, and he had officially moved back into the house and called to quit his job at Armitage and Rist, shocking his employers, his immediate supervisor had said, "You're really giving all of this up? No one does that." He was pulled toward the room his brother had inhabited. And then, once he went inside, he couldn't stay away. Corey sat for a long time on the blue rug, with his old bobblehead basketball player figurines above him on the shelf, nodding vigorously at the slightest footfall, and with Albie's action figures scattered all around. One had an arm raised, one was kicking nothing, one had its torso twisted all the way around into an impossible stance. All of them were frozen into their last, permanent positions. Corey had also taken out Albie's school papers and drawings and notebooks, and was obsessively reading everything, as if there might be clues to be found there and decoded, which would prove, somehow, that his little brother was actually still alive in some until now undisclosed location elsewhere in the world. This was the fantasy Corey had constructed. It relieved him to linger in it. Albie's handwriting was large and erratic, and his teacher had constantly circled words in red pen, admonishing him. "Try to be neater, Alberte." But the content of Albie's work was sophisticated, occasionally even long-winded. In his class essays, he expounded on dinosaurs and Incans and the Big Bang, using statistics to back up his work, but still he digressed. "Try to stay on topic, Alberte," wrote that same teacher, and Corey wanted to punch her in the nose. Then there were the notebooks. At first he didn't understand what they were or what purpose they served. There were three of them in a pile, with that familiar black-and-white egg-drop pattern common to school notebooks everywhere. When Corey opened the first one, it appeared to be a kind of homemade spreadsheet. In his brother's enormous and childlike but highly controlled handwriting were cryptic stats and notes. August 6th, 10 a.m. Temperature, 76 degrees. 15 minutes observation. Motion, some. Distance, 4 centimeters. Velocity, 4 centimeters divided by 15 equals 0.27. August 7th. Rain. No observation. Stayed inside with PlayStation instead. August 8th, 10 a.m. Temperature, 82 degrees. 15 minutes observation. Motion, none. Distance, none. Velocity, none. Notes. Does temperature affect distance and velocity? Channel 22 News says there's a heat wave coming this weekend, supposedly. They are often 100% wrong. We will see what happens. And then, on the weekend, there were further statistics with the notation, waved front left arm. Distress? Can't be sure. Front left arm. Corey didn't know what he had meant. And then he did. He was seized by comprehension and immediately horrified, like someone who has driven hours from his home and then suddenly remembers he's left a pot on the stove. Corey shot up into a standing position. Frantic, he looked around the room. No one had been in here since Albie died except for one of the aunts who had straightened up a little. In the corner on the floor by the window was a box. He crouched down and opened it. Inside was a little empty bowl and a few pieces of old, dried-out meat. This was Albie's pet turtle Slowey's home. Slowey, who had been entirely forgotten and was now missing. Now Corey knew what Albie had been doing in the driveway that morning, why he was so low to the ground, and why his mother hadn't seen him. "Oh my God," he said, and he dropped the notebook and ran downstairs, pushing through the front door without a coat on, peering hard at the ground all along the strip of brown lawn to the side of the driveway. The turtle was there in the grass, easily camouflaged. It had been there this whole time, but no one had thought to look. No one had remembered it even existed except for Corey, who picked it up now and cradled it against his cheek, saying, "Slowey, Slowey." The shell felt dry and cold. The turtle was dead, he thought, and that was fitting. That was appropriate. Slowey and Albie were like Romeo and Juliet and should have been buried in the same casket. A boy and his turtle. Packed together for all eternity. As Corey stood with the flat bottom of the turtle pressed to his face, he felt a rumble from inside the shell that was like the vibration underfoot when a subway train approaches. The turtle was waking up from its hibernation, or perhaps its deep grief. It reached out a pale, mosaic, textured arm and lightly raked Corey's cheek, as if waking him from his own long and fitful sleep. The next day, he contacted his father in Lisbon at the relative's carpet store, telling him in a loud and bursting voice that Albie's death hadn't been Benedita's fault after all. "See? He was lying on the ground, studying Slowey," Corey said. And though he was sure his father would say, "I am so glad to hear this. I'll be on the next plane home," Duarte simply said that he needed to stay in Portugal for now, and that he would be in touch when he could. Over the weeks that followed, his father was only in occasional touch. Corey took scrupulous care of Slowey, making sure his box was clean and that he had ample water and food, and taking him out on the carpet in Albie's room, beside the bed where Corey now slept at night, because there was actually some consolation to be found in lying on superhero sheets in a bed that his grown body filled from stern to bow. In the mornings, he made breakfast for himself and his mother. He suspected if he didn't feed her, she wouldn't eat at all. He made sure she took the medications she'd been prescribed. He checked her arms for scratches. He did the grocery shopping at the Big Y. He drove her to see Lisa Henry, the social worker she'd been assigned. He kept her company. He played the Portuguese card game Bisca with her at the kitchen table and usually let her win. One evening when they were playing cards, the phone rang, and a voice said, "Hello, this is Elaine Newman. Is Benedita there?"
"I'm sorry, she can't come to the phone," Corey said, for his mother never wanted to talk on the phone anymore.
"Are you her husband?"
"I'm her son."
"Ah, you have such a deep voice. Your mother cleans house for me," the woman explained. "I teach at Amherst College. My family and I were in Antwerp during my sabbatical year, and now we're back. I told your mother I'd be in touch when I returned. I hope," she said with a worried little laugh, "she held Thursday mornings for me like she said she would. I should warn her, though. The place is a mess."
It really was. Corey arrived at the house that Thursday at 9 a.m. After all, they did need the money. The Filipina house cleaner, Jai, would have been shocked to see Mr. Corey in pink rubber gloves scrubbing a toilet, he who had never learned how to clean up after himself at all. He spent a lot of time savagely working on the Newman's toilet and the mineral stains in their tub and the grove of dust beneath their enormous four-poster bed whose nightstands held two different kinds of books. Professor Newman's side had a thick hardcover on it called Van Eyck and the Netherlandish Aesthetic. Her husband's side had a paperback mystery with raised letters and a bloody knife on the cover called The Mice Will Play. People's marriages were like two-person religious cults, impossible to understand. By the time Corey had finished the entire house and collected the cash that had been left for him on the Caesarstone counter beside the Sub-Zero, whose surface he had carefully wiped down with Wyman stainless steel cleaner, he felt flushed with industry.
"You take after your mom," said Professor Newman with admiration when she called that night.
The job was his now, every Thursday morning, and he took surprising pride in the simple act of cleaning up, something he had never really thought to do before, because it had been done for him by his mother his whole life, and then, briefly, by Jai. Once in a while, when Greer had come over during high school, or later on during college vacations, she'd automatically picked up the gym socks that Corey had left around, or his sports drink empties. He'd had a lifetime of being catered to and cleaned up after by women, but he only now realized this. Sometimes when he was vacuuming Professor Newman's Persian rugs or ripping an old ratty Princeton t-shirt into strips to use for dusting, he thought about Jai Matapang and felt unaccountably sorry that he had barely spoken to her in Manila, she who had touched all his intimate things, who had braved his filth. Once he had tried to have an extended conversation with her, but it had been extremely awkward. As she bent over the toilet in the shared bathroom, scrubbing away the pinkish-brown halo left by the urine and shit of all of them, plus the vomit that had flown out of McBride one night after they all stayed out too late doing shots with clients at the long bar at the Raffles Makati, Corey approached her and said,
Jai?
She looked up at him, startled, lifting the dripping loop of a scrub brush.
"Yes, Mr. Corey, what is it?"
Jai was tiny, and game hen bony in the grayish windbreaker that she wore all the time, her hair pulled back with a net like someone working a fast food fryer. He flushed.
Oh, I was just seeing if everything is good.
She gazed up at him. Finally, she said,
No, some things are not good. Some things are evil. Some people. The terrorists in Mindanao.
She had taken his question literally, having never heard the colloquial question about whether everything was good. He just nodded in awkward acknowledgement. Then she swiveled her focus back to her task, plunging the brush again into the toilet in this apartment that Corey and Loeffler and McBride kept like this, in part because they were so busy, and in part because they could. At home each day now, in the house where he'd grown up, Corey learned to clean up the place the same way he did for Elaine Newman. He cooked dinner for his mother every night, too. Not only had he never cleaned up after himself before, he had also never cooked a real full dinner in his life either, unless it was a box of Ronzoni spaghetti and a jar of ragu. Every day he began to look through his mother's Portuguese language recipe cards, which at first were as incomprehensible as Albie's scientific notes. Soon he'd cracked this code as well. O-L was oleu, oil. U-P was pouco, a little, and on and on. Corey was pleased with his code-breaking abilities, and the food came out surprisingly tasty. He was now a house cleaner, companion, and cook. He was bringing in a small salary, the house was in good shape, and there was decent food to eat. His mother might never really recover, but she ate and she lived. Sometimes Corey's aunt and uncle came to visit from Fall River, and occasionally they dragged his cousin Sab along. The cousins had disliked each other ever since their teenaged fissure over porn. Sab was still known in the family as a hopeless case, but also a bad influence. The little kids were kept away from him. The situation was delicate. Whenever family gatherings were held at Aunt Maria and Uncle Joe's house, Sab was usually on the premises, and the other parents took notice. "Leave Cousin Sab alone," was the repeated refrain to the little cousins. Or, "Cousin Sab is tired," or, "Cousin Sab's room is off-limits." By 19, Sab and his friends had been reputed to be using and selling cocaine and Xanax. His parents, anguished, kicked him out, then took him back in again, and there he lurked. Home on winter break from Princeton each year, Corey had seen Sab looking more and more broken. The only mitigating factor was that he no longer seemed mean, just ruined, barely filling out his shirt collars, his head bopping forward to an internal beat, a wavy smile always in half play. "Hey, Cousin Corey," Sab said whenever the families were together. "Give me a hug, college man." "What's up, Sab?" Corey would say wearily, putting his arms around his Ichabod Crane-looking first cousin. "Not much, not much. Getting into the Christmas spirit, you know what I'm saying?" But now, once again back at the Pereira household in Fall River for Sunday dinner, 2 months after Albie's death, hoping the visit would somehow force a little bit of life into his depressed and dazed mother, Corey deposited her into the blobby arms of a recliner in the den, with the aunts nearby and a couple of little cousins running around. Then he climbed the stairs to the second floor and banged on the door that he hadn't approached in years. "Soapin'," Sab called, and Corey entered the fetid room where his cousin sprawled on a heavy carved teak bed, smoking a green bong. Sab held up a finger, let the smoke roll from his mouth, and then said, "I am truly surprised to see you here. You must be desperate for friends, living at home and all." "Something like that." "That whole time you were away at your Ivy League college, did you feel better than all of us in the family? Be honest." "All of you? No, just you." Sab tipped his head up and laughed. He was uncharacteristically friendly in response to Corey's visit to his room. "You got me there, and I deserved it. Sit down already." Corey sat in an armchair and took a hit from the bong. The column of old water burbled like a Roman fountain. Soon the room wasn't as grotty, and his cousin not as awful. Corey was feeling fairly relaxed when Sab pulled out a tiny glassine envelope from his dresser and said, "And now the main attraction, better than Beaverama." It was heroin. Snorting heroin, see, like drinking chocolate, Sab explained. Designed to be snorted and never injected. A mellow feel, he went on, like a sommelier. "What do you say, want a bump?" Corey, stoned, said, "Okay." "Well, this is a big day in Fall River." Sab chopped a little brown powder onto glass. "Corey the Great snorts H with his fucked-up loser cousin." "Corey the Great. That's a good one." "Well, you'll feel great in a minute anyway," said Sab, handing him the square of glass and a short piece of plastic straw. Corey remembered drinking strawberry quick with Sab through this same kind of straw. Circus straws, the name on the box had read. He didn't know why he remembered this, but the memory arrived in an image of tremendous sadness and regret. A box of straws that bore a picture of an elephant trapped behind bars in a car of a circus train, and two boys sitting together with pink milk mustaches. Now the powder went into his nostril as easily as if it were coke, which had sometimes been in evidence at parties at Princeton, where so many people had money. There was an MSG taste in Corey's throat from the heroin, part fish and part brine, chemical and fake, but intriguing. Yet almost immediately, his brain was seasoned with a vigorous and lacerating flurry of poison salt that seemed to stream from the holes of some hidden shaker. He seized forward and vomited a straight column of amber onto his cousin's carpet. "Oh my God, I'm sorry, Sab," he said, clapping a hand to his mouth, and then he vomited some more through the spaces between his fingers. At first, he felt only this sick feeling, nothing more, and it seemed as if the drug wasn't going to work on him. In his grief, he must have been drug-resistant, like one of the newer forms of bacteria caused by overuse of hand sanitizer. But then he thought that that was a strange thought to be having right now. So maybe the heroin was starting to work after all. Corey lifted his head a little, and the room buckled and sank, as if the whole house had been built on a sand pit. Corey sank down with it, falling on his side onto the shag carpet, bracing himself with one arm. He stayed there with his eyes shut for a long time, until he heard a reedy-voiced version of Sab distantly saying to him, "You can open them now." He licked his lips and took a moment to try to remember what those words meant. What was he supposed to open? Presents? No, not presents. Eyes. "Open your eyes, Corey." So he did. Incredibly, the world had been cleansed, rinsed off, made softer, and ineffably better. Sab was smiling gently from what appeared to be a patch of sunlight on the bed, and Corey smiled up at him, two beneficent cousins finally reunited in the love they had once felt when they used to kick a soccer ball around the street and look at porn with their teeny-tiny Q-tip boners, imagining the way the world would one day take shape for them both. They should drink glasses of strawberry quick together again now, he thought. They should ride a circus train throughout the land, their arms thrown around the neck of the sweet, lumbering elephant that patiently looked out from behind the bars. Corey remembered that Albie was still dead, but he also knew that he didn't have to wrestle with that thought every hour of every day. Right now was one of those times when Albie's death simply wasn't relevant. He hummed to himself as liquid pleasures rolled across him from a chemical tidal pool. He wanted to tell Sab how relieved he felt, but he had entirely lost the ability to talk, and his tongue was just a wet fish lying in his mouth. So instead of talking, Corey closed his eyes again and was grateful for quiet and immobility. The two cousins stayed that way for hours, barricading themselves in the bedroom and ignoring the bangs on the door of family members who called to them, "The lamb is on the table!
The Sunday lamb. And then, the lamb is getting cold. And then finally, Corey, your mom wants to leave right now.
By the time he made it downstairs, the sky was dark. The little kid cousins had all fallen asleep and been carried out to the cars in their father's arms, and his mother was dozing in the same easy chair she'd been placed in that morning. Aunt Maria was scraping lamb bones into the garbage and loading the dishwasher, and Uncle Joe was already in bed for the night.
"What were you boys doing up there? You missed my entire meal," Aunt Maria said, looking them over with a suspicious eye.
"Were you drinking?" she asked.
"Sorry, Mama," Sab said, though of course neither of them smelled of alcohol.
"Drinking will get you nowhere. You'll turn into a bum."
"I know. It won't happen again." Outside, under the street lamp, Corey helped his mother into the car. Through a miracle, driving 25 miles per hour in the breakdown lane and forcing himself to stay awake and alert, he safely got them home, although it took a long time. The next afternoon, having slept for 13 hours, Corey awakened to a cracking headache that seemed at the cerebral hemorrhage level, and then he remembered the dirt-like powder that his cousin had chopped on a piece of glass and handed him. The headache was the least he might have expected as an after-effect, never having snorted heroin in his life. There was a text from Sab who said, "You want to hang later? More bumps in store for us." As if they were friends now and could return to their early days back in Fall River without any mention of the intervening schism. Corey ignored the message. But when Greer called, he made the mistake of picking up. She was in one of those outstandingly articulate moods she'd been in sometimes lately when she called from New York. She would usually spend the beginning of the conversation asking him how he was doing, using the hushed and joyless voice that people used when speaking to someone who had experienced a terrible loss. But he didn't want to talk about that with her anymore. He had other concerns these days, namely taking care of his mother and the house, and also taking care of Elaine Newman's house. Treating it all with the seriousness with which he had treated a client's presentation during his brief career at Armitage and Rist. Then, when Corey wasn't particularly responsive, Greer would tell him about herself and her own life, which was what she was doing on the phone now, as if everything were normal between them.
"Faith gave a special sermon at All Souls, you know, the Unitarian Church on the Upper East Side," she was saying. "It was all about sexism in everyday life. She can speak to anyone about anything. A reporter from the New York Times came. She's doing a profile. She said this is a great moment for this kind of piece. What with Femme Fatale and those newer websites, and Opus still being so visible, and now, amazingly, us, Loci. The place where women come together to talk about what matters," is how she put it. "I don't know if that's accurate, but I guess now we'd better make it accurate."
"Uh-huh."
"That's all?"
"I don't know what you want me to say, Greer."
"You sound peculiar. Are you okay?"
"I'm tired."
"Me too, actually. Very tired. I'm working a lot," she went on. "Even though the first summit's over, it now starts all over again for the second one. Listen," she said after a moment, "I have some news." When he didn't say anything, she said, "Do you even want to hear it?"
"Of course I do," he said, but having been questioned, he thought, "Do I want to hear it?"
He realized he was exhausted at the prospect of hearing it. He was already pre-exhausted by whatever it was she was going to say. "You know that multimedia event we're going to do?"
"No."
"The one about girls and safe schools around the world?"
"Yeah."
He remembered nothing of such an event, but suddenly he saw girls in burkas and saris and kilts and rags, swinging satchels, riding shaky, thin bicycles, heading down sun-baked dirt roads toward distant, low school buildings. The image was so vivid that he wondered if it was the product of a few last misguided opiate-addled neurons firing into the weeds.
"We're actually going to need to hire a consultant," Greer said. "I know that's your area of expertise, and I can tell you more about it if you're interested."
They were both silent, him taking this in and her letting him take it in. He didn't say anything, so she quietly said, "What do you think?"
"No. Thanks, but no."
"Are you sure? You answered so quickly."
"Sorry. There's no way I could do something like that."
"But why not? You've been home for a couple of months now, Corey. Maybe it's time to start thinking about your life again, even just a little. Would that be the worst thing? It wouldn't take away from your mother."
"This is my life."
"Well, yes, a temporary version."
"I don't differentiate," said Corey, his voice tight. "It's all temporary, obviously. Everything is. My brother died, Greer. My dad left. My mom collapsed. That's the order of things. The world doesn't need my consulting skills, believe me."
"You don't know that."
"There are plenty of people who can take my job at Armitage and do it just as well or much, much better. I'm sure they already have. I was a fake in a suit and tie in Asia, that's all. It's easy to take a recent college graduate and say, okay, come be a consultant, and I'm sure there's real merit to that. But at some point, that recent college graduate is going to need to figure out the world a little, beyond consulting. The non-corporate parts, the human parts, the corners, you know?"
"So that's what you're doing now when you stay at your mom's house all day, cooking and sitting in Albie's room? You're figuring out the world and all of its corners?"
"Yeah,"
he said.
"Exactly."
"Well, I thought I was supposed to be figuring out the world alongside you," she said, her voice shaking a little.
"You were," he said. "And you will be. And I'll be doing it with you too," he added quickly.
The call ended in mutual unpleasantness, and Corey staggered up and fed his mother, and then fed Slowey. He let the turtle sit on Albie's carpet for a while, until finally it opened its eyes and blinked twice, like a coma patient trying to send a message, saying, "I'm still here." How was it, Corey kept thinking, that when a person died, they were no longer anywhere? You could search the entire world and never find them. It was one thing for a body to stop working and be carted away under a sheet. It was another thing for the sense of that person to evaporate. The textural and indisputable sense, as strong but as hard to pinpoint as a gas. Corey opened one of his brother's notebooks and turned to a clean page, then began to write. Date: Monday, May 23rd. Conditions: unbearable sadness exacerbated by foolish heroin use. Brackets: heroin shaken, not stirred, aka inhaled, not injected, because I am not actually a self-destructive asshole, despite my lingering, non-stop sadness. End brackets. Observation: Albie is nowhere to be found. Nowhere. Not here. Not anywhere. You aren't here, are you, bro? In your old Power Rangers sweatshirt? No, you're not. Somehow, this is not an elaborate prank, even though it totally feels like it. Time spent thinking about this today: 45 minutes. Amount that unbearable sadness was lessened by direct thoughts of Albie: 0.00000%. Every day for 5 days, Corey wrote his observations in the journal, but he soon became aware that nothing was changing for him. There were no glimmers of improvement. So by the time the weekend arrived, he left the journal on the desk and sat down on the bed and turned on the PlayStation. All the video games that Albie had loved were in a shoebox beside the bed, and he went rifling through them. If Corey couldn't be with Albie, then at least he could feel what it had meant to be Albie. He sat cross-legged on the small bed, playing game after game that Albie had played. He played Peep Peep and Growth Spurt and Mixed Up Kids and all the other games. Mostly they were loud and clownish and pulled you right in so that you felt yourself leaving this world and entering that other, differently lit one. Some of them were mystical, ambient worlds, like Calyx, a game for adults that Albie had loved. While Benedita slept or wandered around whispering or picking at herself, Corey played.
"Go, go, go," he quietly called to the screen as his little car roared along the Mobius strip of a cartoon track,
and he felt himself galvanized by the colors and the music, and then, when he'd had enough, he calmed down by playing an hour of Calyx. He snorted heroin once more with Sab, but shortly after that second time, he understood from his own wretched response and the days of recovery afterward, even longer than last time, that that was enough, and that any more than that, he would be taken up by it. He would be taken. Instead, he let himself be taken by Albie's video games and notebooks, that whole compact and abandoned world. Greer made another trip to Macapi before a loci event in Cambridge. Though the distance between New York and Macapi wasn't too much greater than the distance between Ryland and Princeton, the trips were less frequent, and it was only Greer visiting him, never the other way around. Whenever she came to see him, the rhythm in the house was thrown off. His mother seemed agitated with Greer around, maybe even self-conscious about appearing unwell in front of her. She retreated to her room and didn't eat. And though Greer kept trying to get him to come down to New York, he'd sworn to her he would. He didn't want to leave his mother for the weekend, even with one of the aunts, who didn't know everything that had to be done. So Greer came there, and it wasn't great. This weekend, Loci would be co-sponsoring a mini-summit about sexuality and the law at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She drove up in a rental car a day early, and she came into Corey's house and looked around. The Pinto's place was clean and orderly again. He'd gotten good at that. But she didn't even comment, and it actually hurt his feelings a little. His mother drowsed in her chair. Eggs were lightly knocking together in a pot of water on the stove, emitting that distinct, hard-boiled smell. Everything was under control here, but Greer just said quietly,
"Corey, what's going on?"
She looked as if she might cry, and he was slightly offended by that. What was so terrible here that could almost bring her to tears? What was she seeing? He'd been trying so hard to manage every aspect of his mother's life, and Greer had come in and basically held a mirror up to everything, which wasn't something he'd asked her to do. How could he not take care of his mother? How could he go back to Manila to be a consultant, when in fact the one who needed his consulting skills was right here, in a house dress with a repeating pineapple pattern, agitated and confused and unwell? How could he return to being interested in his relationship with Greer? Relationships were a luxury designed for people whose lives were not in crisis. For some reason, Greer didn't understand any of this. It was so unlike the way she had always understood everything about Corey since they were teenagers and lay together in her upstairs room, their bodies being revealed to each other for the first time like monuments undraped at a public ceremony. He had shown himself to her, his slightly crooked penis and his heart fat with longing, and then, indisputably, the love he'd been storing up. His toes like fingers, his desire to do something useful with himself someday, to spread money around the globe because he hadn't had much money growing up, and because he'd learned in his economics classes about how everything was connected through intricate systems. And Greer had shown him all that was hers as well, the small, warm body and the muted self that these days was being replaced by something less constrained. She was less timid. Faith Frank had brought her out more than he ever could. But he had the distinct feeling that she didn't understand him anymore, which was news, because for years they had always taken each other's understanding for granted.
"What do you mean? What's going on?" he asked.
"We had a life," she said. "Not living together, I know that, but we told each other things, and we were in it together. Come on, why do I have to say all of this? You know what I'm talking about. You've basically removed yourself from me."
He just looked at her.
This doesn't only go one way, Greer.
You think I've been distant, too? She said. I always call you and text you. I want to hear everything.
Yes, you're very responsible.
What do you want, Corey? Am I supposed to move up here with you, too? Maybe I am, she said frantically. Maybe that's the only way I can show you what I feel.
No, he said. This isn't about obligation, Greer.
But you don't go to me for comfort anymore. You don't go to me for anything, not even distraction. Our lives are just totally separate. You're not even trying. I know you're upset. I know you feel shattered. But when I try to get you to come down to New York to see me and be alone with me someplace where we can really talk and be together, you say you can't.
Right. Because I can't.
I have an apartment now, Corey. I have big spoons. I just don't have you there.
He didn't say anything, and so she kept talking, making it worse.
I know your mother needs protection and care. Of course she does, and you have to see that she gets it. But I know you can get other people to help with that, at least sometimes. It's not the sum total of who you are. I haven't heard you talk about anything else in so long. You seem completely uninterested in the outside world.
In your world, you mean?
He said. And this was a little mean, and he knew it, but it was true.
Her world had become abstract to him. She had stayed firmly in it, planted in it. No, he didn't think she should move here. She shouldn't give up her job with Loci and Faith Frank and come up here to live with him. Though really, he thought for a second, if she had done that, then finally they would be living together. They could live in Greer's bedroom. Her parents would leave them alone. They could live there, and his mother could heal, and he could heal, and they would have some version of a life. But Greer couldn't do that, and he would never, ever ask her to, because she would have to give up so much. This time of life was meant to be about adding on to yourself, not taking away. It was all backward now, and he didn't know how to stop the backward motion from continuing, accelerating.
All right, fine. My world, she said. But also your own world, the one you had.
I don't have it anymore.
You could have a little of it, she pressed. Just once in a while. You deserve it. You're a person, and you still have to live. Why won't you come down to New York for the weekend? You haven't even seen my apartment in Brooklyn, not once. And I sound spoiled saying this, and I hate that. I'm sorry, but I had this whole thing in my mind. We'd get Thai takeout at this place I go to. We'd sit in my bed. We'd walk in Prospect Park. You said you would leave your mother with your Aunt Maria just for one night. One night! And then you always cancel.
The logistics are complicated.
I know they are, but I feel like being involved with me is this gigantic burden that you feel you have to carry out. More of a burden than taking care of your mother. You have to want to do it. I can't make you want it. That's the thing about a relationship. Whoever is more aloof always gets to set the terms.
So now I'm aloof?
Well, yes, kind of.
He didn't say a word, but just sat there, taking this.
Corey, Greer tried. It's okay to still care about things, but you don't seem to believe that. How long are you going to stay in this state where you're totally removed from everything? How many months are you going to keep doing this?
14.
What?
I made up a number. I'm trying to show you how completely ridiculous this line of thinking is. How can I put a limit on it, Greer? I'm needed here.
Aren't you needed elsewhere?
I'm not irreplaceable elsewhere.
You had a plan, and it made sense. Doing consulting for now, saving money, then doing your app. You were so excited about it.
I had to adapt, he said. I'm starting to think that you're the one who can't.
Can we please go somewhere and discuss this? Greer asked, agitated.
So they left his mother alone for an hour and went to Pyland, the pizza place where